The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Dear friends, good evening. And on behalf of the Washington College of Law, I would like to welcome all of you to the third annual Finnegan, Henderson, Farrarbrough, Garrett, and Danner Distinguished Lecture on Intellectual Property. Our law school is honored and proud to host this lecture. Our law school has a long-standing commitment to the field of intellectual property and a keen recognition that IP issues are increasingly intertwined with fundamental notions of fairness and social justice. These include critical issues such as access to information, access to medicine, and free expression, which affect basic notions of human right and human dignity. Our community's dedication to promoting IP is reflected in our wide variety of IP-related initiatives, which include PGIP, a program that promotes an approach to IP law that centers on public interest, and through scholarship and advocacy, the program promotes social justice in a wide variety of IP-related areas, including fair use and access issues, indigenous IP rights, IP and gender, just to name a few. Our Glasgow Samuelson Intellectual Property Clinic, which was one of the first IP-oriented clinic programs in the country, is also a very important contribution to the film. Now in its seventh year, is directed by Professor Peter Jassy, to whom we owe the fact that the clinic is here and the development of this program. We owe to his creativity and commitment with the institution, and I thank him for what he has done for all of us. The clinic concentrates on clinic representation that helps student attorneys better understand the concept of public interest in copyright, patent, trademark, and related issues. We have here also two colleagues who work in the clinic, and really their contributions have been exemplary, both in the realm of teaching and scholarship. Professor Joe Sarnoff and Vicky Phillips were here, and I want to thank them also on behalf of our school. Our law school also offers two LLM specializations in IP through our program on law and government and our international legal studies program. Interested students select courses from extensive curricular offerings and obtain their LLM degree with an IP specialization, focusing either on IP regulation in the U.S. or on global policy and legal issues surrounding IP. I'm happy to share with you that we have the distinguished alumni of this program that have gone to different countries of the world and are influencing the public debate on these issues. The chief negotiator, for example, of Chile on issues of intellectual property is a graduate of this program who has spearheaded events and conferences to others in the region. Through these IP offerings and others, our students acquire essential knowledge, skills, and practical experience, preparing them to become effective advocates and to tackle key issues in this dynamic area of the law. All these programs, including today's lecture, would not be possible without the hard work and dedication of many. For today's program, I would like to thank, in particular, the law firm of Finnegan, Henderson, Farrarbrough, Garrett, Dunnett. I would like to say something about this. In the strategic vision underlying what this school does, it's very important, these partnerships with different institutions that exist in the society. In the past, law schools were the only ones doing research and teaching and storing the result of the research in libraries. Now, in a world that is every day more borderless in terms of communication and exchange of experiences, where we have diverse centers undertaking functions that are not just distributed as separate compartments, we see as very important to link the law schools with these actors in the society for the sake of pursuing our academic mission. So we thank this law firm and their representatives tonight, Robert Litovitz and David Kelly. I also would like to thank the Law School's Program on Information Justice and Intellectual Property, PGIP, including Professor Christine H. Farley, co-director of PGIP, and one of our associate deans for faculty and academic affairs, Christine, within the limits of her position representing the whole schools, has been a tireless advocate for this program, and she's the originator also of this lecture from the side of the law school, and I want to thank her for her contribution. Christine recently returned from China, where she was selected to serve as a delegate to the International Association of Law Schools Conference on Learning from Each Other, Enriching the Law School Curriculum in an Interrelated World. And this is a new internet organization of law schools from all over the world, and she brought there the voice of intellectual property and the commitment of this law school in projecting the issues of intellectual property worldwide. I also would like to thank PGIP Associate Director Sean Flynn, who has been tireless in his efforts to promote this program and who also teaches and is a recognized scholar in the field. Steve Roberts of our Glasgow Summers Intellectual Property Clinic, and our distinguished speaker, University of San Francisco, Professor J. Thomas McCarthy, author of the authoritative six-volume treatise, McCarthy on Trademarks and Unfair Competition. We will hear from him later, and Professor, your coming here has created big expectancy, and it's a big honor and pleasure to have you here. I also want to thank our Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education for its superb organization of this important event. That's an office under constant pressure, as in this law school we have over 70 events per year that attract thousands of individuals, because again, we see that providing a domain where people could exchange views on a high level, it not only advances our academic mission, but at the same time enhances the understanding that the broad public has or should have of these important and relevant matters that affect the way in which they live. And now I want to introduce Robert Litovitz, an attorney with the law firm that is co-sponsoring this event. Mr. Litovitz is a seasoned litigator with extensive experience in litigating trademark and other IP rights, and was most recently recognized as one of the leading lawyers in trademark litigation and dispute resolution by the 2007 U.S. edition of the Legal 500. He's also an author of numerous articles on trademarks, entertainment law issues, and the practice of International Trade Commission, as well as a frequent lecturer on those subjects. So, Mr. Litovitz, I invite you to come here, and thank you for your presence.
This is one of those moments when you have to disclose sad truths. And that sad truth is that I'm not any of those wonderful things. And my name is Richard Straub, who Rob Litovitz, being much more important and busy than I, asked that I come in his place. So I apologize to you for that, but here I am. And the next apology I have to make is that actually, although once I did a lot of patent and trademark work, now I'm what is known as a patent geek and spend most of my time in patent law. Although I do have my face on one article because a number of my other partners did a wonderful job, and I was head of the litigation section at that time, and we were fortunate enough to get an award as the best litigation department in the intellectual property world. So you can say yourself the bald guy who was there beside his partners who did all the work. I will say very little more, other than it has been a great, great honor to have a long-standing relationship with the Washington College of Law. We have had many, many of our partners and attorneys teach here. They've been replaced with better teachers now that are full-time, although we still, on occasion, do teach here. We have gotten a great number of very talented attorneys that have come from the law school, and it's been a wonderful relationship, and we are very honored to be a small part of this series. And with that, I will say thank you.
Thank you so much, Rich. We're glad that you're here. So many of you know how excited I am this evening to have Thomas McCarthy here as our third distinguished lecturer in IP. This is a great coup for the law school and for me as the trademark geek at the law school to invite him here. I was so happy when he agreed to come here, and even happier when I heard about his proposed topic, which I'm terribly excited to hear about. So it's my great honor to welcome you all and to give you a brief introduction of Professor McCarthy. J. Thomas McCarthy, and I'll always think of him as J. Thomas McCarthy because, of course, I've cited him so many times and always making sure I have that J there, is a senior professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, where he has taught for 36 years. He teaches there intellectual property law, trademark law, and copyright law. And he is the founding director of the University of San Francisco's McCarthy Institute for Intellectual Property Law and Technology, for Intellectual Property and Technology Law, which obviously was named in his honor, and that's a great honor. He has so many distinctions, so many things that I could mention that would impress you a great deal, but I'm going to try to be brief because I know that you don't want to hear from me. But he, just to give you a short synopsis, he helped draft the 1995 Restatement of the Law of Unfair Competition. He also participated in the Trademark Law Review Commission, which drafted the 1989 Lanham revisions to the Lanham Act, which my students are very familiar with, have memorized, in fact. He's on the International Board of Assessors for the Intellectual Property Research Institute of Australia. He's, of course, written so much, impossible to count, but maybe more than 25 law review articles, also book chapters. But he's written three treatises on multi-volume treatises on intellectual property, and of course, the most famous and my favorite is the now seven-volume treatise on trademarks and unfair competition law. He has received numerous awards and recognitions, and I'll just list a couple. He was listed as a leader in the field of information technology and intellectual property law by the best lawyers in America. He's in Who's Who Legal's Global Trademark Lawyer of the Year. He won the President's Award of the International Trademark Association, also known as INTA, and we have an INTA representative here tonight. He won the Padishaw Medal for Excellence in Teaching Trademark Law from the Brand Name Education Foundation. He won the Lattice Professional Author Award from the same organization. He won the Centennial Award in Trademark Law from the AIPLA. He won the Jefferson Medal from the New Jersey Intellectual Property Law Association. He won the Rossman Award from the Patent and Trademark Office Society. He's won other awards, which I won't mention, from the AIPLA. And he was named the most influential trademark expert of the 20th century by AIPLA. And when INTA's president gave him the association's President's Award, the then president, Catherine Barton Barrett Park, described Professor McCarthy as, and this is a quote, literally a household name when it comes to trademarks. I would actually go farther. He is, in fact, a rock star in the trademark world. People want to come up to him and touch him, in fact.
No touching.
On a personal note, I was first introduced to Professor McCarthy through his treatise as an entry-level trademark attorney. And I used his volume so frequently that I got in trouble with my colleagues who were complaining that I was hogging the volumes in my office. I remedied that problem by convincing the firm to buy a separate set of the treatise volume just to keep in my office, which I referred to constantly. And in fact, I negotiated for that same deal when I came here to the law school. And if you come to my office, as all my students have, they will see the seven-volume blue books on my shelf, which I refer to all the time. So Professor McCarthy has certainly taught me, quite literally taught me trademark law. I was not his student, but he taught it to me through the treatise. And therefore, I think bear some responsibility if I'm ever in error in my teaching. I've certainly learned a few things about trademark law since those days, but nevertheless, I do go back and check his treatise to make sure I'm right whenever I'm learning these new topics in trademark law. So it is just my great pleasure now to introduce you to Professor McCarthy, who will now come and deliver the lecture. Thank you.
Well, Christine, thank you. I never heard myself referred to as a rock star before. There's no way I could live up to that introduction. As Christine said, I'm a senior professor, which I just made up that title at my school, and which means I didn't feel like teaching anymore after 36 years, but I didn't want to walk away, so we invented the title senior professor. So I retired from classroom teaching 5 years ago, but I taught a number of different law courses for 36 years, and as every professor and you students know, after class, there's usually a few students who come up to the professor with questions. And someone asked me recently if I could remember what was the best question that a student ever asked me. And in fact, from all those probably hundreds of hours of classes over 36 years, I did remember very clearly the best question. And I remember that at the moment the student asked the question, I privately thought in my own mind, that's a really dumb question. But after I tried to answer it, it dawned on me later that that was, in fact, the most perceptive and thoughtful question a student had ever asked. It was an introduction to intellectual property class, and I've been talking about the public domain as the backdrop or default against which all IP rights exist. And a student came up after class and she asked, Professor McCarthy, I was very interested to hear you talk about the public domain. Can you recommend a book I can read about the public domain? And my first reaction was, well, that's a dumb question. No one would write a book about the public domain because that's just what's left over after you exhaust all the IP rights and there's nothing left. The public domain is just a label for all those things that are free for the public to use and copy to their heart's content. Almost all of the legal articles and books are about intellectual property owners' rights to exclude, not about users' rights to use. So I told a student, I'm sorry, there is no such book. You'll just have to look at the books on intellectual property rights, and if you find there's no such rights in a given thing, then it must be in the public domain. She seemed disappointed. Now I think she was perfectly entitled to be disappointed. I realized later that was a very sharp and perceptive question. Why is all the thinking and writing on IP always about the rights of IP owners to exclude? Now, trademarks in particular, out of the three of patent, trademark, and copyright, give the owners the right to stop others from using the mark to infringe or to dilute their mark. But where does the public fit in to this lineup of rights? What about those who want to use another person's trademark? Why is all the legal analysis focused on the right to stop people and not on the rights of everyone else to use these things and use them legally? The United States Supreme Court has told us many times over many years that the default is the public domain. The exception is ownership of intellectual property, which means the right to exclude. So legally protected zones of exclusive rights, like patents, trademarks, and copyrights, they are exceptions to the general principle of free copying and free imitation. The client asks, well, counselor, can I use it? Well, it's not as if attorneys don't answer this kind of question every day in the real world of practice. Can I improve on this technology? Can I digitally manipulate this image? Can I use this other company's logo and name in a comparative ad? Well, that's what I propose to do today. I propose to look at trademark law from the viewpoint of everyone other than the trademark owner. I want to look at people who want to use that word or image or shape that someone else claims as their mark. I want to discuss some of the ways that those other than the trademark owner can make proper and legal use of trademarks. You know, ordinary people, not just businesses and entrepreneurs, ordinary people use people's trademark, other people's trademarks all the time, legally. Has anyone in this room recently used somebody else's trademark without permission? I bet you have. I bet, in fact, that each and every one of you, within the past day or two, has used somebody else's trademark without permission. Well, here's a couple examples. Maybe you said you're going out the door. Hey, I'm going to Starbucks. Anybody want something? Wait a minute. You didn't get written or oral permission from Starbucks to use their trademark. Maybe you wrote down a shopping list. Cheerios, Coke, Tide Liquid, No Scent, Smart Balance Spread, small can of WD-40. Wait a minute. You did not have permission from those five companies to write down their trademarks that way, but you did not stop a millisecond to think that you needed permission or license to use another person's trademark orally in writing to refer to the product identified by that brain, because your intuition told you that it was okay. You, like everyone else, have been doing that your whole life. Why were these uses without permission still legal? I think it's because all these kind of uses on your shopping list were what could be called referential uses. You were using the trademarks to refer to the original mark. You did not use the mark to identify anything you were selling in the first place, and you were certainly not using it in any way that could confuse anyone. Now, this shows an important difference between trademark law on the one hand and patent and copyright law on the other hand, because a trademark is not supposed to be what is called a right in gross. It's not a right to exclude everyone from using that mark in any context. We know that trademark law is a confusion-based kind of IP. We know that infringement is tested by whether there's a likelihood of confusion as to source or over sponsorship or affiliation or connection. But too many trademark owners think, or maybe they just wish, that they had a right to stop anyone from using their marks in all sorts of different ways that they don't like. We know they think that way because they send out cease and desist letters that reveal their views. The sending and getting of cease and desist letters is, I think, maybe the real battlefield of IP law. Then, of course, there's trademark anti-dilution law, which doesn't fit comfortably in this picture at all. And I will have something to say about that later. So what would you respond if some smart aleck, loudmouth challenged you for writing all those brand names down on your shopping list, saying, hey, you don't have permission to write those things down? I mean, what is your response on the merits other than saying, you know, get a life? Well, I'm sure you might mumble something about, it's a kind of fair use thing. Many of you are familiar with a category of uses that are not an infringement of somebody's copyright. It's called a fair use. Copyright fair use, if you know anything about copyright, you realize it's a very fuzzy, very amorphous, foggy concept. People are always arguing about what it is and what it permits. Law professors usually think that pretty much all the copying they do is a fair use. And I know from personal experience that the law students are convinced that everything they use and copy, either digitally or by photocopying, that's all fair use, because I'm a student. That reminds me of the time some years ago when I was teaching a copyright course, and I was using Mel Nimmer's casebook. Nimmer was, and his son still is, the author of a famous treatise on copyright. I was lecturing, and I was walking up the aisle. I looked down on a student's desk, and my jaw dropped. A student, instead of buying a copy of Nimmer's casebook, had photocopied those parts of it that I had signed to read. And this was not just a few, but hundreds of pages. Well, I was astonished that in a course on copyright law, he thought it was okay to copy hundreds of pages from the book of the leading author on copyright. So I looked, I said, how can you do that? And he smiled and said brightly, oh, it's okay, prof, it's student fair use. Well, I was so astonished by his chutzpah that I didn't turn him over to the copyright police. Unfortunately, at some time in the past, judges borrowed the term fair use from copyright law and applied it to a totally different concept. It has nothing to do with copyright. in trademark law. Oh, and what a lot of confusion and misunderstanding that has caused because of that dual use of fair use in copyright and trademark. Not only that, but I was, as I will mention, in the past few years, even trademark fair use has split into two separate flavors of fair use, and they have almost nothing to do with each other. So it's a semantic mess, and let's try to clear up that mess right here and now. Now, sometimes the term fair use is applied to all non-infringing uses of a trademark. I think this is not correct. Fair use covers a relatively small subset of non-infringing uses which fall into either of those two flavors I'll talk about. So I suggest that your on-the-merits response to the smarty pants who challenge your shopping list is, oh, clam up. It's a non-infringing use. Nobody is being confused about anything. And non-infringing use covers a wide scope of things. And I think it's a good response to a lot of situations. For example, let's say you have a client who opens a small coffee stand in the lobby of a downtown office building. Your client uses the mark Star Shine Coffee Bar. But then your client comes to you in a panic because she just received a cease and desist letter from Starbucks claiming that her mark infringes the Starbucks mark. Well, then your job is to tell Mr. Bucks that he does not own all the stars in the caffeine sky. But I think you should not argue that your client's use is a fair use. Why not? Well, because Mr. Buck's lawyer will respond that you are wrong. It's not a fair use. And I think she will be correct. Well, what is it? I think your answer is it's a non-infringing use of the Starbucks mark. Your client's Starshine coffee bar is simply not similar enough to Starbucks to be likely to cause confusion. And it's certainly not similar enough to be likely to cause dilution. So fair use is a subcategory of non-infringing uses. The oldest kind of fair use is known as a classic fair use. Hey, Professor, you mean like classic Coke, right? No, I don't mean like classic Coke. Those of us of a certain age can remember way back to 1985 when Coca-Cola changed its flavor to be more like Pepsi because blind taste tests said people prefer Pepsi. So Coke said, well, let's make our stuff taste more like Pepsi. And all the Coke fans complained. So the company went back to the old formula and called it Classic Coke. But Classic Coke as a trademark is not a classic fair use of anything. That was a dead end. A classic fair use is a defense to a charge of trademark infringement under which a junior user argues that I am not using a descriptive or geographically descriptive or personal name in a trademark sense. Rather, I am using it only to describe something about my goods or services or to describe where they come from or name a person who's involved in the business. The only right of exclusion the trademark law creates in a descriptive word is in the new secondary trademark meaning of the word. The original descriptive primary meaning is always in the public domain available for use by others to describe their goods. That's called free competition. The acquisition of secondary meaning can achieve trademark status for descriptive terms like Best Buy for electronic products, but they cannot prevent me from advertising my McCarthy's electronics branded products in my stores with this claim, I guarantee you will get the Best Buy in a new digital TV at McCarthy's Electronics. That doesn't mean that maybe the CEO of Best Buy may not yell at their lawyers and say, I want you to stop McCarthy from doing that, but that's not the law. In a famous example, which in fact was won by David and Sigrun Kane, attorneys right here, who are sitting in the front of the room, my fans, won by them in Chicago, the Seventh Circuit held that the words sweet tarts were descriptive for the flavor of Sweet Tarts branded candy, but had achieved secondary meaning and the mark had incontestable status. But the owner of the mark could not stop the Cane's client Ocean Spray cranberry juice from advertising that its juice had a sweet tart flavor. That is a good example of a classic fair use. Classic fair use was the issue in the United States Supreme Court's microcolor decision 3 years ago here in Washington. Lasting Impression used the term microcolors as a trademark and it had a registration that was incontestable. The MicroColors product was a range of colored pigments used by trained professionals for both cosmetic and medical uses. The accused use by KP that triggered this lawsuit was a use on a color chart. You see, that's the exact accused use. The trademark owner, Lasting Impression, argued this was a trademark type use. This was not a classic fair use. The district court dismissed the claim on summary judgment, saying there's no infringement because it's a classic fair use under the federal statutory defense. The judge felt that that was true as a matter of law, regardless of whether there was or was not a likelihood of confusion. To the district court judge, the evidence supporting the existence of confusion simply wasn't relevant. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed, said that's wrong to talk about a classic fair use defense without focusing on the likelihood of confusion. To the Ninth Circuit, a use cannot be fair if confusion is likely. Supreme Court unanimously held the classic fair use defense does not put the burden on the defendant to argue that the challenge use is non-confusing. In other words, Supreme Court emphasized the trademark owner always, always, always has the burden of proving that there's a likelihood of confusion. So we end up with this balance that the Supreme Court said that there is a relevance, there is a place for likelihood of confusion in the classic fair use defense, that evidence of likelihood of confusion can be factored into the overall balance to determine if the use is fair. The court has, I think, invited the lower courts to factor into the used fairly part of the fair use defense evidence that bears on likelihood of confusion. And on when the case went back to us in California, the Ninth Circuit, that's exactly what the Ninth Circuit held. Let me talk now about the other flavor. We had classic fair use. Now, there's another flavor of fair use called nominative fair use. And it is a use of another's trademark to identify not the defendant's goods or services, but to identify the plaintiff's goods or services. This is not an infringement so long as there is not a likelihood of confusion. And this has been called a non-confusing nominative use because it names, nominative names, the real owner of the mark. Now, unlike the classic fair use defense, a nominative use analysis is not an affirmative defense. It's merely an alternative way of analyzing and thinking, is there is or is there not a likelihood of confusion, the kind of confusion that constitutes trademark infringement. In the 1992 New Kids decision, Judge Kaczynski wrote the opinion. I think Judge Kaczynski was your speaker here last year, right? Well, he invented the thing, and here we are. We're left with it. He said that it is legal to use a senior user's trademark in a non-confusing way to identify the senior user's goods or services. Unfortunately, for clarity, he called this a kind of fair use. In the New Kids case, newspaper USA Today conducted a survey in connection with a story about a concert by this pop music group, New Kids on the Block. The survey asked young readers, which of the five is your favorite? And to participate, callers would dial into a 900 number and be charged. So there was a commercial aspect to it. 3 days later, the results of the poll were published, and the New Kids on the Block sued USA Today for making commercial use of their trademark without permission or payment. Court of Appeals said that this is a non-infringing, nominative, fair use of the mark. Because it did not imply sponsorship or endorsement of the singing group of anything having to do with this contest. Well, what does this mean? I think this means, for example, in comparative advertising, Pepsi can use Coca-Cola's mark to advertise Pepsi tastes better than Coke without infringing the Coca-Cola trademark. And if you notice, if you watch Pepsi ads on television over the past few years, you've seen that there is sometimes, amazingly, a lot of mention of Coca-Cola as their arch rival. So a nominative fair use is just a label for one subset or category of cases where a mark is used in a way that does not cause confusion is therefore non-infringing. The Ninth Circuit, as the inventor and primary owner of nominative fair use, has told us that three things are necessary. They have not stated the three in this order because since MicroColor this is something that the plaintiff has to argue, not the defendant. It's not a defense in the classic sense. The plaintiff has to show that product or service has to be something which is readily identifiable without use of the mark. In other words, do you really have to use that mark to refer to the plaintiff? Secondly, have you used it more than is necessary to identify the plaintiff? And thirdly, did you do something, they did something that falsely suggests a connection? One of the most famous applications of this was the Barbie doll song case, which involves a parody where the trademark is used to identify that you're poking fun at. For example, use of the Barbie trademark was permitted in a song which made fun of the vacuous party girl image that is evolved from the Barbie doll. Judge Byrne in the district court in Los Angeles denied a preliminary injunction that Mattel sought, and then he dismissed the case on summary judgment. Now, Judge Byrne found no likely confusion and no dilution by tarnishment of the Barbie doll trademark as a result of the song. The defense was that Barbie is an icon in American culture, and this was protected as a nominative fair use, as well as free speech under the First Amendment. In other words, in order to make fun of the Barbie girl image, defendants had to use that name. How else would people know what you're poking fun at? The Ninth Circuit affirmed on grounds the Barbie doll name did not cause confusion, but the Ninth Circuit felt, for whatever reason, they didn't have to pick up that tool called nominative fair use. Rather, they picked up another tool called the Ginger Rogers test. Under the Ginger Rogers balancing test, yes, Ginger Rogers could balance because she could dance really well, but there's a different kind of legal balancing where a mark used in an accused expressive work, like a song or a book or a movie, is prohibited as an infringement only if it had no artistic relevance to the underlying work. It's kind of a dangerous question to ask a judge. No artistic relevance to the underlying work, or if there is artistic relevance only if the use explicitly misleads as to the source or content of the work. Here, the Barbie Girl title did have artistic relevance to the song, and the song title did not explicitly mislead as to any connection with Mattel. Now, lucky you. You get to hear part of this really dopey and cheesy song. You get CDs on the way out. Now, Mattel appears to have zero sense of humor about people who try to make fun of Barbie, because for such people, Mattel has a take-no-prisoners approach. It sued Tom Forsythe, a Utah artist who took 78 photos of Barbie dolls in pretty weird situations. He called his series Food Chain Barbie, and he said his message was to critique, quote, the objectification of women symbolized by Barbie. He sold a few postcards with the photos and made a grand total of $3,600. Well, you decide how well he succeeded in conveying his message of social criticism. Here are four of Tom Forsythe's photos from left to right. We have Blender Barbie, Barbie Enchiladas, Malted Barbie, and Martini Barbie. This is art, in case you don't know. These were found to be, and now Mattel sued. They paid lawyers to go to court, spend a lot of money. They didn't think it was funny, but the court said this is a fair use under both the copyright claim and the trade dress claims. The Ninth Circuit said, quote, defendant used only so much as was necessary to make his parody of Barbie readily identifiable, and it is highly unlikely that any reasonable consumer would have believed that Mattel sponsored or was affiliated with his work. The Court of Appeals then thought that Mattel was overreaching a bit. It said Mattel's claims, quote, may have been groundless and unreasonable and a basis for pretty substantial attorney fees. Around 1998, the Beach Boys performing group split up, and former Beach Boy Al Jardine and his own band then performed using advertising that prominently featured the Beach Boys trademark. Jardine's group performed as, quote, Beach Boys, family and friends. Some show organizers booked his band, thinking they were getting the real Beach Boys, plus some added guests. That's where the family and friends came in. The Ninth Circuit affirmed the summary judgment that Jardine's use was an infringement of the Beach Boys trademark. First, Jardine argued that his use was a classic fair use, and the Ninth Circuit properly laughed this out of court, saying that Jardine did not use the Beach Boys mark to convey its primary descriptive meaning of young men who hang out at the beach. Then Jardine argued it was okay because it was a nominative fair use. The Ninth Circuit rejected this, saying this kind of use did not fit within the third factor of the nominative use analysis because he suggested in his advertising that he and his group either were or were sponsored by the original Beach Boys, and that was false. But of course, if you're worried about him, Jardine could have, but he didn't, make a profile, low-profile use of the term Beach Boys just to let audiences know he used to be, you know, once in a while I was a Beach Boy. All fair uses are not the same. Classic is not the same as nominative. The problem is, of course, Judge Kaczynski named this new category a nominative fair use, but I think you see now it's something quite different from the traditional classic fair use. All they share is that label. But some courts and commentators just can't see the difference. It's like thinking a Mini Cooper and a Hummer must be the same thing because, well, they're both cars. I hope you see now that the two flavors of fair use have nothing in common except for that label. A lot of lawyers and even some judges just can't seem to get beyond that label. They think they must be the same thing because they both are called fair use. And one of those who thinks they are the same is Judge Marjorie Rendell on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Pennsylvania. It's an interesting piece of judicial trivia. Judge Marjorie Rendell is the first lady of the Keystone State. She is married to Ed Rendell, the current governor of Pennsylvania. In the controversial 21 versus LendingTree decision in 2005, a divided Third Circuit panel rejected the Ninth Circuit's nominative use analysis. They said Judge Kaczynski's all wet. Judge Rendell wrote the majority opinion. Three real estate franchisors, Century 21, Coldwell Banker, and ERA Associates sued LendingTree. LendingTree had an online referral network of real estate brokers. Now, some of those brokers were also parts of one of the three franchise organizations. And in some of its web pages, LendingTree said that we will give you access to a national network of brokers representing the country's leading real estate companies, including Coldwell Banker, ERA, and Century 21. Well, that was true. But the three franchisors argued that even mentioning them in this low-profile way created a likelihood of confusing consumers into thinking that LendingTree had some sort of formal licensing or approval relationship from these three franchisors, which it did not. The majority characterized the Ninth Circuit's position as creating a nominative fair use affirmative defense, almost like, you know, like a statute of limitations. And the court said, that's bad law, because it improperly puts on the defendant the burden of negating likelihood of confusion. And Judge Rendell said, well, that violates the rule laid down to the Supreme Court in the Microcolor decision. Based on this thinking, the majority rejected the Ninth Circuit's approach and substituted a different analysis and said they would apply a shortened version of their usual 10, count of 10 factors, to determine if confusion is likely. If the plaintiff proves a likelihood of confusion under that test, said the court, then and only then, the defendant has the opportunity to assert nominative fair use as an affirmative defense. Judge Michael, this was 2-2-1 decision, and the dissenting voter was Judge Michael Fisher, who vigorously dissented. Now, here's more judicial trivia. It's interesting that in 2002, before he was appointed to be a federal judge, Michael Fisher ran as the Republican candidate for governor of Pennsylvania. Fisher lost the election to, guess who, Ed Rendell, the husband of Judge Marjorie Rendell, who wrote the majority opinion in the Century 21 case. So is anybody interested in doing a mini-series on this? Judge Fisher said in his dissent, and I think very correctly, the Ninth Circuit's decision, he said, quote, make it clear the test is nothing more than a likelihood of confusion substitute. It was never intended to be an affirmative defense. So I cast my vote for Judge Fisher and against Judge Rendell. I think Century 21 decision is quite wrong, and it will unfortunately spread a virus of confusion and uncertainty in trademark law. And confusion in trademark law always raises the cost of doing business. It makes prediction of the law more difficult. It raises the expenses of doing business and puts more power in the hands of owners of famous trademarks. I think the only thing that separates the Ninth Circuit from other courts is the Ninth Circuit thinks that its special purpose nominative fair use tool is more useful than the multi-purpose do-all list of factors that's used in all other cases in all other circuits to judge likelihood of confusion. Now, as the Monty Python used to group used to say, now for something entirely different, and something entirely different is dilution law. And any discussion of what can be done legally with other people's trademarks has to mention the wild card in the deck, and the wild card is anti-dilution law. I think those of the students that have sat in your trademark law class know that the first federal anti-dilution law was enacted in 1996. The Supreme Court in its 2003 Victoria's Secret decision effectively eviscerated the statute. It said the statute requires proof of actual dilution of the famous mark, and that's just about impossible to prove. Unhappy with the Victoria's Secret rule, the International Trademark Association wrote a new statute. Congress passed the TDRA, Trademark Dilution Revision Act. It was enacted in law almost exactly 1 year ago, and now we have a whole new ball game, with all new rules, starting all over again with a new federal anti-dilution law. Now, I always thought that any anti-dilution law was a very specialized legal tool, a tool to be used only sparingly and only in unusual cases. It should be like a strange-shaped tool way down at the bottom of the toolbox, and you only use it once every year or so. But too many trademark owners look at it as a fits-all cases, handy-dandy deterrent to squash all uses of the mark. Now, one thing the new anti-dilution law continues and expands is a statutory list of things that do not constitute dilution under federal law. So looking at this as I am at trademark laws, things that people can do with other people's marks, this is the Magna Carta. Lanham Act 43C3 defines three statutory defenses or exceptions. There's some overlap between these. They don't all fit together nicely because the exceptions were the focus of a lot of lobbying and compromise during the congressional hearings on the bill. But obviously, all these statutory defenses are designed to accommodate, inside the statute, the principles of free expression and free speech. And as you can see, the statutory defenses provide a safe harbor for comparative advertising, parody and criticism, news reporting, commentary, and any non-commercial use of a famous mark. Another potential shield for those who use other people's trademarks is that a non-trademark use does not dilute. So only if the defendant uses the word as a trademark could the allegedly unique and strong link between the plaintiff's mark and its goods be weakened. And the new Trademark Act, the new Anti-Dilution Act, emphasizes this point by not once but twice stating the accused use must be as a quote mark or trade name. For example, a novelist who uses a famous mark in the body of a story is not subject to the anti-dilution law because the accused use is not marked as a mark or trade name to identify either the author or the publisher. Well, this is an excerpt from Mr. Tough Guy, a novel. The drug dealer known as Escalade Man smirked as he leaned against the Coca-Cola sign, smoking a Marlboro and swigging his favorite beverage, Sky Vodka and Tropicana orange juice in the carton. Tropicana says, hey, we don't want our mark being associated with drug dealers. That dilutes and tarnishes our image. But even assuming that such a literary use was captured by the TDRA as a trademark use, which it is not, it should be exempt under statutory exemption for fair use as an identifying use. So the law uses a belt and suspenders approach to immunize such uses from liability for dilution. And the same result, I think, for use of trademarks in the content of motion pictures and television programs. This is the cover of the prestigious and serious Economist magazine for the week of September 1, 2007. What if you were an in-house attorney for Google? And the CEO said, hey, you, come here, look. Look at that. What are you going to do about that? I don't like what they said about our company inside, and we did not give them permission to use our mark. And the exact same, look, it's our logo, the colors, it's all there. I want you to either sue them or send them a letter asking for damages and make them promise never to do that again. Now, I'm not making this up. It may sound extreme to you, but I'm a member of a chat group run by the International Trademark Association, and a non-lawyer put this, not the same trademark, but the same kind of question. He said, this is terrible. How can I stop these people from doing this, putting this on the cover of a magazine? Well, if I were the attorney, I were the you, hey, you, come here, I would say, cool off, calm down, nothing illegal about that. It's neither infringement nor dilution. It's a non-confusing, nominative fair use. And if you want to take that magazine on, you better be prepared for the editorials about big companies trying to violate free speech. What about this? Is this a dilution of famous Rolls-Royce mark, Sterling River Wine, the Rolls-Royce of Idaho wines? I think that use of a famous trademark as a measure of prestige should not be dilution. Another hypothetical example, Lexus sedans, Rolex watches, Chanel perfume. Now there's Blue Circle Gourmet Coffee. Same thing. Do you recognize this? This has become one of the most iconic works of modern art. Did you ever ask, well, wait a minute, why did Andy have to use a real trademark? Couldn't he have changed the mark? Why did he have to use the exact same almost photographic image? Couldn't he have changed the mark or trade dress and still make his artistic point? That, I think, is a question that judges should not ask. In my view, judges should not use the anti-dilution law to second-guess the creative decisions made by literary and visual artists as to the artistic significance of a trademark. Don Stewart is a visual artist whose genre is drawing pictures of familiar objects made out of strange ingredients, such as a Victorian house composed of bits and pieces of boats, or a motorcycle made out of kitchen implements. He made and sold this drawing of a Volkswagen bug composed of, what else? Bugs. See them? He then got, in January of 2006, a very nasty and obnoxious cease and desist letter from a lawyer for Volkswagen, accusing Stewart of infringement and dilution of the VW bug image trademark, and demanding that he pay 25% of his revenues from sale of that picture and turn over to VW for destruction all copies of that artwork. This is what I mean when you see what some people think their trademark law gives them by the way they write cease and desist letters. Hopefully there's a happy ending, because Stewart found an attorney who told VW what it could do with its outrageous and inflated claims of infringement and dilution. If you have a lawn or do any gardening, you probably agree that the mark John Deere is famous. John Deere's competitor, Yard Man, ran this TV ad we're going to see in the early 1990s, a television commercial for its Yardman lawn tractor shows an animated miniature version of its competitor John Deere's Leaping Deer logo being chased around a yard by a Yardman tractor and a barking dog. Look out for that dog. Keep your eye on the dog.
A very expensive maker of lawn tractors likes to say, nothing runs like them. The makers of Yardman tractors take exception to that. The Yardman lawn tractor uses a powerful engine to mulch, bag, and side discharge, and it has a hydrostatic transmission. So it runs like a do-no-what, only it doesn't run for nearly as much money. Yardman, American-made, American-owned.
Cute dog. In a controversial decision in 1994, the Second Circuit affirmed a preliminary injunction based on dilution under the New York statute against that ad. The key finding was that alteration of the plaintiff's mark, making that the deer getting chased around by the yard man and that yappy little dog in a negative setting constituted a form of dilution. But the John Deere decision is highly controversial precedent because critics, including myself, argue that it unnecessarily constricts the commercial free speech rights of a seller to make fun of its competition, to poke fun of its competition, and therefore is a form, a favorite form of comparative advertising. What about Shamrock Software, compatible with Microsoft Windows Vista? This kind of, I think, fits with or compatible with use of another's mark. I don't think it's infringement. It's a nominative fair use. It's not dilution. Of course, we could argue that maybe they're using the Windows trademarks too big and too prominently. Finally, I think everyone recognizes this as a Google search page. Can you tell the difference between the advertising and the objective search results? Do you know what a sponsored link is, and do you know why they're there? My time is running out, so I only have a second to just mention this issue of sponsored links. Internet search engines such as Google make their money primarily, and their stock keeps going up and up, because they sell keywords to companies. The result is, as soon as you enter a keyword in Google search engine, the search results screen, in addition to the usual list of results, also shows sponsored links to the companies that bought the right to have their link appear, and companies complain that a search engine like Google is responsible for trademark infringement by selling their trademarks to a competitor. And the claims allege that computer users like you are confused and deceived into thinking that the linking ads were authorized or approved by the company whose trademark you typed into the search engine. Well, there's little doubt that search engines are taking commercial advantage of the drawing power and goodwill of the marks, but the policy question is whether this activity is fair competition, presenting you with useful alternatives. There's other places to get this, or on the other hand, whether it's a form of unfair free riding on the fame of famous marks. So far, we have no clear answer from the courts, so stay tuned for further developments on sponsored links. Well, this brings to an end my tour of some, but certainly not all, of the ways that you or your client can use other people's trademarks, and what's even better, to use them legally. Thank you. Yeah, sure.
I'm going to get the lights up here in a minute, and we'd like to invite your questions.
Easy questions.
This is a great opportunity. Hard questions, please.
Oh.
We have two microphones set up. I think they might be on, so it would be great, especially since we're recording this, if you could come up to the microphones, and if you want to form lines on each side, and we'll just go in order. So please. Thank you.
Well, I have a question regarding that last slide and on there, and regarding initial interest confusing and sponsored links in particular key. I'm actually writing a paper on it now. I sort of have, I think it's more of a more competitive, it's a fair competition thing, or if there is actual violation going on, it's actual use of commerce issue. Comes up a lot in cases where there's been an actual analysis of whether they use those trademarks in commerce or not, whether they're actually selling something on the website.
Well, of course, let me just interrupt you for a second. I know I've talked to Google's attorneys, and of course, their argument is we don't want to get to this issue of likelihood of confusion, because that gets very expensive and you get big trials and it's a lot of money. What we want to do is knock these cases out by saying we're not making a, quote, trademark use, right, of these marks. And I say that's very interesting. Where do you find that in the Lanham Act, that it has to be a trademark use? Now, I said trademark use is part of dilution because the statute says so. But the Lanham Act doesn't say for normal, old-time infringement, likelihood of confusion, it doesn't say it has to be a trademark use. But they say, well, it ought to say that anyway. Okay. And we're Google, and we can, so I think that's primarily what most of the cases that you find when you're writing your article of talking about this use in commerce, is it a trademark use? You look at my book, and I say, well, that's not what the statute says. Then you get to the next question, likelihood of confusion. What's your take on that?
To putting up a billboard misleading to where the location of a store is, and letting real-world situation works out best, but in the internet context, when you do a search, you want to have as broad a look as you can, so you're going to use as many terms as you can. There's also misspellings, and it's kind of hard to narrow down your use of a trademark on the internet in those contexts, and it's hard to analogize, and I think that's what a lot of terms are difficult with. I don't know if you can take that proper now.
My take on it is what you see on the screen. Are people going to be confused? Because that's cutting through all the guff. That's Google's argument. People are going to be confused because they can't tell the difference between sponsored links and the real results. So it seems to me what we ought to look at is the way that this particular search engine, whether it's Google or Yahoo or somebody, or Microsoft, the way they line things up. Can you tell the difference between sponsored links? You know, can you tell me on here, where are the sponsored links? Now, I know there's some on the right. You know that those two up on the left-hand corner, they're also sponsored links. How do you know that? But they're on the top of your results list. So how do we know that? Well, we'll have to go out and ask people, right? We have to take a survey. The survey so far, and people haven't been doing this. Like, surveys are expensive. But I think they're afraid to do it because they know what the results will be. You are all in this room very sophisticated web users. You know, I think there's a lot of people who don't get it. But we can't come to a conclusion about the argument because it's a factual argument about whether people are confused between the two, because that's what the arguments are so far.
Hi, Professor McCarthy. One of the points I took away is that trademark holders are shameless about asserting infringement when it doesn't exist based on various uses. Is there anything that can be done to deter that conduct other than defending lawsuits, such as, again, in the patent and copyright context, you have misuse, but even misuse doesn't impose liability for those wrongful assertions?
Well, maybe I've gotten cynical in my old age. I don't think there is any magic wand to stop it. Now, one reason I chose this topic, and it's primarily aimed at students, because it's your job to stand up to the big company, and it's your job to write a responsive letter. And you want to write it persuasively, you want to stick to the law. But you've got to say in some terms, you know, knock it off. You're wrong. And then I think the sword against that would be, as in the, food chain Barbie, attorney fees. You know, you're going to spend my, okay, I'm going to hire some expensive lawyers, and then you're going to pay for it because this is abusive litigation. And what you will find is, in some cases, not all, it's like the playground bully because nobody's ever stood up to them. And if you stand up to them and say, don't get all bent out of shape, you know. Sure, we can work something out here. Okay, forget it. You know, but that's your job. And unfortunately, there's a lot of small businesses and artists and songwriters, etc. They go to an attorney who is not sharp on IP law, like you students are and will be. And they say, I don't know, it's a big company. You can't fight a big company. You better do what they say. Make them go away. Jeez, you know what litigation costs? And so that's why I say the real world is in this world of cease and desist letters. And it's an old story, you know, if you make people be, you know, act in a certain way enough times, you say, well, that's the law. As far as I'm concerned, we can stop people from doing these things. But that doesn't make it so, and that's not the law.
Don't be shy.
Oh!
I really ask from the point of view of the trademark case going through the decades, the last 15 to 20 years. Do you see any movement away from judges saying, oh, you cut out a survey or you're in trouble here? Or, and secondly, even if there's no movement away, can you give us an argument to get away from this feeling that you have to have a survey and a trademark case?
Well, I don't have an easy answer to that question. I have always been privately of the view that you don't need a survey if you have a clear case otherwise. And I think most lawyers with experience in the field know the difference, and I address this to your students. One of the flashes, light bulb will go on over your head at some point early in your career, hopefully. And you say, oh, I get it now. It's all about telling the difference between a hard case and an easy case. And if it's a hard case, I tell my client, you know, I know this is a hard case. I can't, you know, wishy-washy. But there's a lot of cases that are easy cases. And the easy cases, I don't think you need a survey. But it's the hard cases, and that's why I suggested a survey here, because nobody knows whether there is or is not. Nobody knows because different search engines use different lineups, and they change their lineup. And I don't know any other way to resolve that question, whether people are confused or not. But I think in your ordinary run-of-the-mill case, I don't think you need much. But, you know your judge. Some judges are afraid to stick their neck out. So, where's your survey? But on the other hand, and you've seen, and I've seen too, judges who listening. And we had a judge in San Francisco after 3 days of survey testimony. She said, I don't pay much attention to these surveys. Really unreliable. So we went through all that. 3 days of examination and cross-examination of all these survey experts on both sides. So, no, I don't pay much attention to that. So you got to, you know, it's unusual in trademark law, and I address this to students, unlike patent and copyright law, it's all about what's going on in consumers' minds. And the survey is not the last word. I want to say that also, because surveys can be spun. Depends what questions you ask and how you put together the results, and like any other kind of evidence, you get the answer depending on what question you ask. And so surveys are not sort of a flash of truth. They're just one more piece of evidence to put into the big picture.
I heard you say earlier something that was music to my ears, and I want to make sure that I heard it, because it would help a lot if I heard correctly. I've been doing a lot of work recently with documentary filmmakers, mostly on copyright fair use issues. Of course, documentary filmmakers also have, or think they have, trademark use problems, and that's why so often you see trademarks that have been pixelated or otherwise modified. It's because a lawyer or sometimes an insurance company has told the filmmaker that there is some trouble ahead unless they reluctantly make those modifications. Now, I've spent a fair amount of time sort of arguing with some of those lawyers and some of those insurance companies about the issue, and I think we have more or less straight now the notion that there is no real risk of normal Lanham Act liability when a filmmaker has incidentally captured a logo on a shirt or a hat or a billboard. But then those lawyers and insurance companies come back and they say, oh, but there's this dilution stuff, and we really don't know about that, and we're worried, so let's go on cutting that stuff out or pixelating it. What I heard you say is there's nothing to worry about.
That's what I said.
Good.
And I think, yeah, people who insure, especially documentary films and all kinds of films, maybe the students don't know this, but Hollywood is very risk adverse as to legal risk because there's so many other risks of making movies that flop, so that they don't need this additional risk of somebody suing us and trying to get a preliminary injunction. So very risk adverse to get insurance for a expensive media project, and they're very conservative about this. But on this, I think they're just barking up the wrong tree. But I think the statute is crystal clear. It's not a trademark. We're not using it as our trademark. Get it? Yeah.
Oops.
Oh, you broke it, Sigrun. That's all right.
Speak loud, anyway.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk a little bit about this First Amendment business, and I'm going to be a little bit of a supporter of the trademark owner. And if you go back 20 years,
or so ago, there was a case I'm sure you're familiar with. It was Enjoy Cocaine. And there was a poster, and it had the Coca-Cola script, and it had an R in a circle, and it said Rademark. Coca-Cola sued and was successful in stopping it, both on grounds of likely confusion and dilution. And indeed, they did have some people write in to suggest or to question, how could you associate your product with this drug, and this is terrible. Then there was another case in Screw Magazine. There was a depiction of the Pillsbury Doughboy and Doughgirl doing some very pornographic loving from the oven. And the Doughboy had as a head, instead of his Doughboy face, CEO of Pillsbury. So there was a suit, and that was one of the first cases, actually maybe it was the first, where the court distinguished between confusion and dilution and said, well, I don't think this is confusing, but it is diluting, and it does certainly besmirch the image of what is supposed to be a wholesome product. Now, in Barbie's defense, I can imagine why Mattel felt that to depict Barbie being attacked by these vintage appliances, and she's naked in many of these shots. She's in one of them is a toaster oven where she's skewered and she's turning around, and then she's beaten by this mix master. And it certainly isn't an image that if you were a parent of whose child was enchanted with Barbie, would like to see associated with this product. Now, I know when you read the decision that Mattel was very heavy-handed in discovery, and there were some discovery abuses, and that could have been a reason why the court said there should be an attorney's fees award here. But I think it's going a little far to deter trademark owners from bringing claims. This is a long question. Based on the trying to protect an image of their trademark. You know, 20 years ago, Enjoy Cocaine, that's no good. Should it be decided differently today? There's my question.
Well, Sigrid, I'm glad you spoke up for the trademark owner tonight. Somebody in the room should speak up for the trademark owners. I have to go back to this new statute. The new dilution statute makes it very clear, to me anyway, that unless the defendant is using that as their trademark, the statute just doesn't apply. Now, maybe you could use one of the state. I didn't say anything about that, but many states, about half the states, have their own anti-dilution statutes. The courts are very strong on First Amendment. A lot of federal judges feel that one of their important jobs is to protect free speech. And maybe they put their thumb on the scale a little too heavily.
What about, there's a case, I think it's still, the appeal is still pending, Chewy Vuitton versus Louis Vuitton.
Yeah, that is, yeah.
And the district court said, oh, that's parody, and it's clearly okay under the dilution statute. And on appeal, the issue is, well, they're using Chewy Vuitton as a trademark.
As a trademark, yeah.
So then that doesn't really...
Well, then you have to shift gear. Yeah, that's right. Then you would have to go directly to free speech.
But how would it... You see a difference between... But under the dilution statute, if it's used as a trademark, that fair use doesn't apply.
That's correct. You have to go directly to the First Amendment. You can't... The statute doesn't give you a defense. You have to... that's only if there's likelihood of confusion. That's clearly if you're confusing people, you're not within the First Amendment. That's not free speech, to confuse and lie to people. But that's not what dilution is. Dilution is not about confusion. So I think their argument, the defendant's argument on appeal, would have to be that we're making fun of Louis Vuitton, and we're using it as a trademark, which is definitely more difficult case for the defendant than anything I've talked about here tonight. Because when you start using it as your own trademark, that looks more like an infringement or dilution.
Well, I would argue that the dilution, then I'll sit down, the dilution statute says, all right, it's a defense if it's a fair use, and then it gives the examples of fair use, which would be a defense. And but it's only a defense if it's not a trademark
Correct.
Use. But one of the defenses, if it's not a trademark use, is non-commercial use, which I always thought meant the First Amendment. So I'm thinking if it's trademark use, the First Amendment shouldn't kick in.
I don't know the answer to that, Sigrun. I'll think about it. It's a tough question.
So I'm getting back to what Jen Fine Rising and the Hillsborough Doughboy case. When you think of recent developments like the Two Live Crew case, copyright case, do you think that concept washes over and indicates a kind of title change in sentiment toward in the courts, toward how one looks at that sort of thing? So that, I mean, looking at it from the standpoint of Two Live Crew, one would say Coca-Cola will just have a moment. This is a free society in which people mouth off. That's not, of course, how the Jedi Rising case was decided, but that was 20 or I don't remember how many years ago. So I'm asking you, one, do you think that one of the factors influencing the decision in cases of this kind, if they were decided today, would be the washover of copyright law of Two Live Crew case into trademark law? And second, what about the possibility, when you have a state claim of dilution, of saying that 43C represents a public policy decision by Congress, and it is therefore preemptive, the same way Sears and Comco were preemptive of unfair competition law in the patent field? So to hear, Congress made a decision, struck a balance, it's not up to the states to strike a different balance. How do you think of those two possibilities as brought to bear on these cases now, raising the same kind of issue?
I think in answer to your first question, I think, yes, there is a washover from the Supreme Court. You know, all the federal judges get their cue from the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, I think that has an effect. And secondly, I don't think the courts are likely to find a traditional preemption of state anti-dilution laws. What I think is more likely is that the states or a federal court applying a state law would use the federal law as persuasive interpretation of how to apply a sort of public domain fair use response. I think that's a safer approach and one much more attractive to a judge to take. And some of the, I think in the new version of INTA's model state Anti-Dilution Act, it says federal law is persuasive in the interpretation of this law. And I think that's the more likely direction that things are likely to go. Yes?
How far do laws like for trademark and copyright go in terms of, I know, you know, in the past, people try to copyright trademark specific phrases like
to copyright like a slogan?
Yes.
Yeah.
What constitutes a trademark to be protected? Anything from identified product?
Almost anything. We have the functionality rule. That's carve out. You can't get a trademark right for something that makes something work better, like a shape. That's only patent law. But otherwise, pretty much anything that you can smell, hear, see, that does the job of a trademark, which is to identify and distinguish, then it's a trademark. I don't know if you were asking whether you get a copyright on an advertising slogan. The answer is yes, and that's a very fuzzy line between copyright law and trademark law. The more words you have, the more it looks like a story or a poem. That's copyright. The fewer words you have, and then the ultimate question, I don't know if your professor would be mean enough to answer you this, can you get a copyright on one word? You know, could I get a copyright on Coca-Cola? Generally, most people would answer, no, you can't do that. That's trademark law. It's a little more difficult to answer, why not? What is exactly the reason? Well, I'll leave that for you to think about.
Okay, we'll let this be the last question. I also do a lot of work regarding use of real elements in films and things like that. And increasingly, I see the argument made that while historically people had no expectation that real products that appeared in films were sponsored or endorsed, now with product placements, consumers actually probably have the opposite effect, where their expectation is that a product was intentionally put there and sponsored by. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that sort of turn.
Yeah, I've heard that argument a lot of times. I'm not sure how that injures anybody. If I'm confused into thinking, if I see people drinking from a Coca-Cola can in a movie, and I think, well, Coca-Cola paid for that, and in fact they didn't, who does that hurt? I'm not sure.
Just curious what you're
Yeah, no, I never thought that was a very persuasive argument, even if people do assume, well...
What if they're drinking Coca-Cola while they're snorting cocaine?
Yes. Well, I had a big argument.
You have to catch that in your document for either the drug abuse.
Yeah. I never thought that made people think, well... That's what happens, see, when you drink Coca-Cola. I had, some years ago, a knockdown, drag-out argument with a lawyer from the L.A. Dodgers who said, we want to stop people in movies in Hollywood from showing bad guys wearing an L.A. Dodgers cap. Bad guys who raise, you know, cocaine and, you know, make cocaine and raise marijuana and do bad things because... That will make kids, you know, young kids think, the bad guy. I thought that was the wackiest argument I ever heard. I said, boy, you think that's what the kids think? I don't know.
Well, I think through the lecture and through the Q&A, you can imagine why Professor McCarthy's treatise is beloved in the field. He takes really messy areas of the law and makes them clear. And I want to point out one thing that I think people really value about his treatise is that he states the law as it is, and he also states his opinion and doesn't confuse the two, which is a very important thing in authoring a treatise and very helpful, especially when he comes up with the right answers and is on the right side of these issues.
Sometimes.
So please join me in thanking Professor McCarthy for this lecture. And we'd like to present Professor McCarthy with a plaque that recognizes that he has delivered the third lecture in our Finnegan Henderson lecture series. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And please come back next year when we'll have our fourth annual lecture, which we haven't announced yet who the lecturer will be, but it most likely will be on the topic of patent law. So we hope to see you next year again in the fall here. Thank you.